roll.
Chair Duggan.
Here.
Vice Chair Abbott.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Hanshofsky.
Here.
Representative Fabricio.
Here.
Anderson is excused. Benjamin.
Present.
Barrero.
Here.
Botana.
Here.
Kennedy.
Here.
Franklin.
Present.
Griffiths.
Here.
King.
Here.
Plakin.
Here.
Rudman is excused. Steele.
Here.
Stevenson.
Here.
Tant.
Here.
Temple.
Here.
Tremont. Woodson.
Here.
Thank you. Good morning. This is the February 6, 2024 meeting of the Insurance and Banking Committee. As a reminder, please silence all electronic devices. Members, please remember to turn your microphones on and off when speaking. Our first bill is HB 851, Nonprofit Agricultural Organization Health Coverage. This is Representative Anderson's bill, but Representative Griffiths, you are... Yeah, sorry, I didn't see you down there. You are recognized to present the bill from your seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you noted, pitch hitting for Rep. Anderson this morning. So HB 851 is a nonprofit agricultural health coverage bill. In Florida, we have deeply rooted culture of supporting our agriculture industry, and HB 851 just expands on that track record. This bill updates statutes to allow nonprofit agricultural organizations to offer health coverage options to their members. The organizations must meet the following criteria. The entity must have a substantial business purpose unrelated to the health plan coverage. They must exist for more than just simply obtaining the health coverage. The entity's functions are controlled by its members, who also control the health plan. The entity makes coverage available only to those participating members, their employees, and their beneficiaries. These member-driven health plans will expand access to the more rural areas of our state while providing affordable health coverage options for some of the hardest-working Floridians, our farmers, and our ranchers. And that, sir, is the bill.
Thank you. Members, any questions on the bill? I see none. We have no amendments. We're in public testimony. Andrew Walmsley, Florida Farm Bureau, waves in support. Thank you. We have no other public testimony. We're in debate. Members in debate? Any members in debate? Seeing none. Representative Griffiths, you are recognized to close.
Wave closer.
Thank you. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Duggan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Abbott.
Yes.
Ranking Democratic Member Hanshofsky.
Yes.
Representatives Anderson is excused. Benjamin.
Yes.
Barrero.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Kennedy.
Yes.
Fabricio. Franklin.
Yes.
Griffiths.
Yes.
King.
Yes.
Plakin.
Yes.
Rudman is excused. Steele.
Yes.
Stevenson.
Yes.
Tant.
Yes.
Temple.
Yes.
Tremont. Woodson.
Yes.
Thank you. By your action, that bill will be reported favorably. Our next bill is HB 543 by Representative Black, Board of Directors of Banks. You are recognized to present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, Ranking Member. I'm here today to present House Bill 543, Boards of Directors of Banks. The bill stipulates that if someone has previously served on a board of a bank doing business in this state, which subsequently became insolvent, such person would be disqualified from serving on the boards of directors of any other bank for 5 years after the previous bank's insolvency. Members, this will help ensure integrity in state bank leadership and accountability and protect the banking public here in Florida. Members, that is the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Ranking Member Hanshofsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Black, thank you for the discussion we had prior to this meeting. Could you just talk about how we're making sure that we're not kind of targeting board members who had nothing to do with the insolvency?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for what I think is an excellent question. So the language in this bill is predicated upon the assumption that the captain should go down with the ship. And if someone is on a bank board and they're making bank decisions, they get a vote to those decisions. And rather than participate in a decision that would damage the bank, they ought to resign. And that's the language in the bill right now that helps to preserve that level of accountability. Now, subsequent to our conversation, Representative, you pointed out, and I think rightly, that innocent actors could get caught up in that, perhaps unintentionally. And since it's hard to find good people in every industry in our state right now, it seems prudent to craft language that might ensure that we protect innocent actors. And there is language in the upper chamber for that purpose, and I'm going to work with stakeholders and am in conversations with them now, actually, about refining such language, and we will look to amending that at a future stop. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. So I guess the thought is that, are you saying that it's board of directors that are the cause for banks failing?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. Well, look, any major failure of any major enterprise, it usually has a number of causes. But this is about accountability. And the board is, and rightly should be under the law, the entity that's accountable.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the scenario where a bank is struggling, wouldn't it be quite certain that it would fail if all the board members decided to resign out of fear it may fail and they would be blacklisted?
You recognize.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for that question. We want to make sure that people who come into a board, look, in banking as in other industries, there are people who are turnaround artists. And that would be an example of an innocent actor, such as we were just discussing. And I think there is wisdom in ensuring that we not inadvertently harm innocent actors. We want good people to come in and try to save banks when they can. And that will be the purpose of those discussions going forward.
Follow up. Rep. Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Black, how would you save good actors when the law is going to apply to everyone who is on the board? You say you want to save good actors. Let's just say a board member did not have anything to do with it. How are you saving good actors? That's what I want.
So recognizing that that's not currently in the bill, but go ahead and answer.
So thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. It's a good question, and although not pertinent to the current language, it's forward-looking, and I appreciate that. So when you have a board meeting, they have minutes of the board meeting, and you can tell who voted for what. And if someone, if a bank board undertook a reckless action, you can tell who supported the reckless action and who did not. So that would be a way for us to establish accountability, again, going forward, forward-looking.
Follow up.
Just one more message. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this legislation be retroactive?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. A retroactive bill of that type, I don't think, would be constitutional. I will say no.
Follow up. Thank you. Okay. Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I'm clear, because in the beginning you mentioned going down with the ship. So are we now saying that some folks don't have to go down with the ship?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you, Chair. I have listened to stakeholders' arguments. I believe that the original language in this bill is very strong, and it is predicated on the belief that you ought to have the absolute strongest deterrent for our banking system. However, we are in, to some extent, uncharted waters. We can't find employees sufficient to put a hamburger and fries and give you the correct change at a fast food restaurant. And one would imagine that it's a difficult thing to achieve in bank boards as well. Considering that, it might be prudent. And in fact, after listening to people on this committee and in other conversations that I've had with stakeholders, be prudent to ensure that we make a more nuanced piece of legislation going forward to protect innocent actors while still protecting the public. And I think we can do that. Thank you for the question.
Rep. Stevens.
Thank you, Chair. I think this is an interesting issue, and I appreciate what you're saying, because that was one of my questions. As an accountant, sometimes you get asked to be on boards to help fix things, so I appreciate where you're headed. Not that that's the only thing, attorneys, I'm hearing a little, you know, there's a lot other well-qualified people that assist with turnarounds. I was just out of, do you know, does Do we have similar provisions that apply to the people on the administrative side, the CEO and the CFO and the general counsel, that are advising the board? I think the board has an important role, but they are not, you know, always in the inner workings.
You're right.
I just was curious. I mean, the like the president of the bank, the CEO, are they still allowed to go to another bank? That's my question. Do you know?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I think there's an awful lot of overlap. It's not uncommon for a CEO to also have a seat on the board, for example, and so thus they would be encompassed. There are a series of other regulations that would apply to officers of not just banks, but all sorts of financial institutions. But this one applies strictly to board members. Now, this could start a conversation, and at some future date, we might decide that there's more that we should do to protect the banking public. But this begins that conversation, and it's a conversation that we need to have because banks have failed. We had the largest bank failure last year since 2008 in California, and we don't want that to come here. Thank you again.
Mr. Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last question for me. I'm sitting here thinking, would this act also to deter some really good people that you may want on a bank from saying, you know what, I just don't want to be bothered. I don't want the possible liability.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. No, I think good leaders are not deterred by being told that they will not be able to serve on a future board. I think good leaders come in and say, I'm a winner and I'm going to do this. And integrity is imperative in that entire process. And I think good leaders know that. They have integrity. They don't expect to be one of those people. I'm not sure what happens to people in leadership positions that sometimes causes them to stray. But we need a correction for when that does inevitably happen. It is a part of the human condition. Thank you, Representative.
Rep. Tant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, what other items does your coming amendment include besides just board minutes? What other items are going to be up for review for determination of whether someone's a good actor or a bad actor?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. Well, I really can't discuss in detail an amendment that doesn't exist yet. I am simply addressing the members of this committee and saying that I hear you and that I am talking to stakeholders, and this is how the process works, right? We're going to listen, and we're going to incorporate language going forward to make what I believe is already a good bill more nuanced and more reflective of the concerns of the representatives in this body.
Further questions? Seeing none, I see no amendments. We're in public testimony. Anthony DeMarco, Florida Bankers Association. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Anthony DeMarco, Florida Bankers Association. I hope I'm here for the last time this session in front of you. I'm sure you're hoping that. I appreciate the time. We've endeavored to get together. We haven't really had a chance to really get into the weeds on this bill. I had to check oppose on the sheet because I don't believe in checking for information only. We think there's the problems with this bill as it's currently formed is some of the questions it would relate back. So if you were on a bank board, look, banks fail for lots of reasons like any business. You can be in a community, you're a small bank. If your leading industry fails, like has happened in our area where there was a hurricane and a paper manufacturer went out of business, their big, large employer, then you could have the bank fail like a bunch of businesses involved in that community will fail. There's nothing, there were no wrong decisions made, every decision that was made. You can have banks that made decisions like any other business that were good at the time, and either in hindsight or the economy changed and they had problems. This would only apply to state charter banks. That's another problem. It would not apply to national banks. It would not apply to out-of-state banks. If a Georgia bank came in here, a Georgia state chartered bank, it would not apply to them. So it's only Florida chartered banks and I believe, no, does it include credit unions? No, I can't remember because I'm getting the Senate bill mixed up in my head. I think it's just banks right now. So so we've got problems with it. We think there should be a finding that the board member was actually culpable. I don't know what the right word to use in the failing of the bank, not that they were on. You've had, you know, you just can't resign from a bank board. And somebody asked a question, if it becomes a death spiral, I think that would happen. If the whole board resigns, you know the community that looks is going to say, what the heck's happening down the street? I'm out. So that's a problem. You could have a person who wants to come in. I think I heard someone mention this, what I call a white knight, for lack of a better term. They come in to try to save the bank, to recapitalize the bank. The bank still fails, and now they're on the hook. So you're going to disincentivize a lot of people going forward. I know good leaders don't worry about risks, I think is how you put it, and they don't necessarily. But if you have this chance of not getting into it again, you're not going to be part of it. So we're going to continue to work with the sponsor. We've had conversations on the other side. We just think there should be a little more clarification. We do think that the FBA thinks, rather, not what I think. No one cares what I think. It should be a finding of, for a lack of a better term, culpability by that board member that they were the cause of the bank failure, and not having to go back and prove your innocence through the minutes, et cetera. So I'll answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
I see no questions.
Oh, that's good for a change. Thanks. Take care.
We have no other public testimony. Members in debate. Ranking Member Hunchofsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Black, I want to thank you for the discussion and the willingness to hear our concerns. I would like to see amendment language before being an up on this. I'm just concerned at the message it's sending. I know people who've served on bank boards and all sorts of boards, and the good people don't want to run when the ship is struggling. They want to help the ship. And I think legislation like this will cause people to not want to, they'll want to cut and run for their own reputation. And good leaders sometimes don't want to get involved in things that feel like they could be a gotcha. That's why I know a lot of wonderful people in my community who don't want to run for office. And I just think it's a little too stringent right now. There's too much room for innocent people who are trying to help to be targeted. And I look forward to the upcoming amendment language and hoping that when I see that, that I can be an up on the bill. But I want to thank you very much for reaching out, for all the discussions, and for really working to get this bill to a good place.
Rep Steele.
Thank you, Chair. And Rep, thank you for bringing this great bill. I would tell you that I'm up on the bill, obviously. I think it's a great bill. I think we need to hold people accountable when stakeholders and individuals in the community are losing their assets because somebody did something wrong. A couple of things I would ask that you look at is, you know, it should be all financial institutions, whether or not they're based here in Florida or not. That's number one. Number two, make sure that in there that the CEO / president's following the rule or of what the board requested, because sometimes they're rogue and they don't necessarily listen to the board. Three, whether they jump off the ship pre-closure or post, I would make sure that if they were responsible for the failure, they're also held responsible. That's it. Thank you.
Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I told you I'd be up on this bill. I have some concerns, but I'm going to take you at your word that we're going to look at doing some amendments, because I've been one of those leaders who serve on boards. And unfortunately, I had a board to fail at one time. I had an entity to fail at one time, despite my votes, which would have shown I was one of the actors who was not, who had a lot of no votes on actions. The problem is that those people who run the business day to day have a large part to play in whether an institution fails or doesn't fail. A board sets the parameters. The board sets the rules. But other people do the day-to-day stuff. And unfortunately, markets and those people can cause a thing to fail, and there'd be no fault of the board members. So as other folks have said, as you take this forward, you know, look at those the other reasons why things fail. It's all not just the board. All right, thank you.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Chairman, and I appreciate this bill for this for one important reason. I think frequently, I'm not just targeting banks, but even elected officials sometimes don't take their responsibilities as seriously as they need to and should, and they have a duty to do that. And we've seen problems with not-for-profits and other things. That's beyond the scope of the bill, and I'll get called out for that. But I do think it's important that members of a board, if they see something that is inappropriate, we've had publicly held companies that went under because of a rubber stamp board, that they have a duty to, you know, to the shareholders, to, you know, the people they serve, if it's not-for-profit, those types of things, and for the bank. But I do agree with the conversation that, you know, sometimes it's something that's reasonably unforeseen in the market. There are concentration of risk requirements for consideration, which it's shocking that the one on the West Coast failed and that they totally missed that, their assessment of the risk of that. But like right now, there's commercial loans going down all over the place at a rate that would have never been anticipated. So I appreciate that you're looking at culpability for bad decisions, perhaps over endowing the executive with, you know, benefits or things like that. Just somebody who's culpable in making a malfeasance, a bad decision, maybe there should be some consideration that they may not be on a future board because they need to take their duty seriously. And that is my, I look forward to seeing the improved bill. Thank you.
Rep. Tan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm so sorry I didn't get back to you yesterday. I just saw that I missed your text and I was tied up in committee. I represent two communities that have state chartered banks that are community banks in them. And they are the ones that are subject to the whims of their economy and to a local business that's a big business that closes their doors and what have you. So I don't like that they are singled out in this bill. The other thing is I do know that there are laws on the books already when someone when a bad actor does, in fact, do a bad make a bad decision or make a, or do something criminal. I am going to have to go down on the bill today until I see the amendment. I understand where you're trying to go, but I think it's got to be a lot more specific before I can get there today. And I will actually lean in and help you work on this with all the stakeholders if you'd like me to. So, but I'm going to be a no today for those reasons. I just can't. I think it's overly broad and doesn't contemplate some of the things that are in the marketplace right now for these bank board members. Further, I will say that in Madison County, somebody asked me today, well, these bank board members are paid. They get a lot of money. My little Madison County bank pays $250 to a board member if they show up. If they don't show up, they don't get paid. So it's not like a big conglomerate with all of these, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars paid to be a board member. These are small banks that are really hanging on and doing their very best by their communities, and they're most vulnerable under this bill, as well as probably the most responsive to their communities for doing the right thing under this bill.
Further debate? Seeing none, I'll just add, I look forward to the amendment. I encourage you to take advantage of the expertise on this committee. Some of these stakeholders are going to be very helpful, I think, going forward. With that, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for the constructive debate and feedback. And know that it'll be taken to heart as this process moves forward. And know this, is not an anti-bank bill. We need our banks. They're the financial lifeblood of our economy, and we want to make sure that they protect the respect of the banking public, because it is upon that everything that they do rests. Bank runs and bank insolvencies can be precipitated by a loss of trust, by us being proactive and being nuanced in this process. We will help protect integrity, thus protecting trust, and thereby protecting the banks themselves. I ask for your favorable support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Duggan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Abbott?
Yes.
Ranking Democratic Member Hanshofsky?
No.
Representatives, Anderson is excused. Benjamin?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Hannity?
Yes.
Fabricio? Franklin?
Yes.
Griffiths?
Yes.
King?
Yes.
Plakin?
Yes.
Rutman is excused. Steele?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
No.
Temple?
Yes.
Tremont? Woodson?
No.
Members, by your action, that bill will be reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, our next bill is HB 893, Coverage by Citizens Property Insurance Corporation, by Representative Lopez V. You are recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, members of the committee. House Bill 893 instructs Citizens to reevaluate the area in which it offers policies to provide wind-only coverage. Citizens may amend the wind-eligible areas subject to legislative approval by developing new eligibility criteria and rates for such policies. In 1972, wind coverage was provided in Monroe County. Following the Hurricane Andrew disaster in 1992, the Department of Insurance, now known as the Office of Insurance Regulation, held a series of hearings and meetings around the state in areas where wind coverage availability had become a concern. The result was that wind coverage was expanded into more than 23 counties. Following the creation of Citizens in 2002, wind-only coverage had been offered in 29 of Florida's 35 coastal communities. The wind-only eligible boundaries have not been reviewed or changed since the creation of Citizens by the legislature in 2002. That is the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Lopez, for this bill. Who's going to do the study to determine the wind-only boundaries?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. Rep. Benjamin, it will be Citizens, and hopefully in conjunction with the Hurricane Commission. I think at this juncture, so much has happened since 2002 in our state with the storms, and I think we've got a whole lot more information and data available to us now that will allow them to actually, I believe, get some criteria that has some data to support it.
Follow-up.
Why Citizens and not hurricane modeling?
You're recognized.
I think what we've said to Citizens is, since they are the ones who have been providing the sort of, I think the data that is now, they've collected a lot of data, so I think that they understand that they are not just the experts, there's other experts as well that they will be partnering with.
You recognize?
Are we mandating that they look at other models, or are we just giving them a blanket that they can do it on their own merit?
You recognize?
We are not mandating that they partner with specific partners to do this, no.
Rep. Stevenson.
Thank you. Can you help me understand the criteria that they used in the original for wind only? I thought anybody who wasn't able to get insurance could go in if they weren't, you know, I thought there was more general criteria. Thank you.
You're recognized.
As I understand it, Rep. Stevenson, it was mainly conversations that took place around the state and people asked to be in it. Because there was not a wind-only available to them.
Follow-up? Okay, further questions? Seeing none, you are recognized to present amendment number one, barcode 674781.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment makes the following changes to the bill. It requires Citizens to seek approval of its eligibility criteria for wind-only coverage every 5 years, beginning in 2030, rather than every year as proposed in the bill. And it also requires approval of the wind-only eligibility by the legislature, but requires approval of the wind-only rates by the Office of Insurance Regulation rather than the legislature. And that is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions on the amendment? Seeing none. I see no amendments to the amendment. We're in public testimony on the amendment. We have none. We're in debate on the amendment. Any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, you're recognized to close.
Waive close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Then, seeing without objection, show that amendment adopted. We're back on the bill as amended. We have public testimony on the bill as amended from Travis Moore, Community Associations Institute, waiving in support. Thank you. We have no other public testimony. Any debate on the bill as amended? Seeing none, you're recognized to close.
Waive close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Duggan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Abbott?
Yes.
Ranking Democratic Member Honchowski?
Yes.
Representatives, Anderson is excused. Benjamin?
Yes.
Barrero?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Kennedy?
Yes.
Fabricio? Franklin?
Yes.
Griffiths?
Yes.
Keene?
Yes.
Clayton?
Yes.
Rudman is excused. Steele?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Tremont? Woodson?
Yes.
Thank you, members. By your action, that bill will be reported favorably. Congratulations. Our next bill is HB 731 by Representative Botana. You are recognized to present from your seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill adds additional factors that to the Office of Insurance Regulation must consider when determining whether a rate filing or rate change for motor vehicle insured policies is excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminative. In addition to other factors, the Office of Insurance Regulation must also consider certain recovered and returned funds. This bill also requires if an insurer that has been damaged because of violation, one-sided statutory chapters parts of section to and obtain a repayment or refund claims paid pursuant to PIP insurance coverage. Members, that is the chair, that is the bill. Thank you.
Questions? I see no questions. I see no amendments. We are in public testimony. Kim Driggers, Florida Chiropractic Association. You're recognized.
Chair, good morning, Chair Duggan, Vice Chair Abbott, Ranking Member Honchowski. My name's Kim Driggers. I'm General Counsel to the Florida Chiropractic Association. I want to first thank Rep. Botana for bringing this good bill. In a time of increasing auto insurance premiums, this bill will help bring transparency to the process to require auto insurance companies to report to OIR the amount of money that they're recovering in these clawbacks of insurance recoveries. For about a decade now, some of the top some of the top auto insurers have had a practice of going after insurance fraud, which is really required of them under the statute, but they wait for approximately 5 years and recover a very large amount of money. It is our belief that this information is not being reported to policyholders. It's the money is not going back to the policyholders, and that OIR isn't receiving the information as to how much money they're recovering. This is not about fraud. You may hear testimony that it's all about fraud. It's really just about being transparent and adding, just making specificity to the statute that aside from the judgments and savings that the insurance companies are required to report, that it's also these millions of dollars that they've been recovering for the last 10 years that are being required to be reported to OIR. And there has been some litigation. You may hear that this information is being reported to OIR. We don't think it's being reported specifically enough. Affidavits of some of the top actuaries at one of the top auto insurance companies have reported that they report that they investigate insurance fraud to the OIR, but it is believed that the actual amount of money that they're recovering is not being reported. The second part of the bill codifies existing case law, and it's for the 20% copay that's required in PIP. PIP pays 80% of insurance claims. The statute states that the 20% is not required to be paid back at every single office visit, or if somebody has a surgery, that huge 20% balance isn't required to be paid at the time of service, but afterwards it codifies existing case law on that. This is good policy for Floridians at a time of increasing auto insurance premiums, and we would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Michael Carlson, Personal Insurance Federation of Florida. You're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair, Ranking Member. I'm Michael Carlson with the Personal Insurance Federation of Florida. We're a nonprofit property and casualty trade association. We represent large national writers who write auto and homeowners insurance in the state. I want to apologize to Rep. Botana. We've not had a chance to talk about this in detail. I'll echo my friend Anthony DeMarco. We're just digging into it. I will say this very much respectfully. The bill as crafted seems to misunderstand how auto rates are made in the state. We are not able to claw back, to use the previous speaker's term, fraudulent overbilling and park the money somewhere. We can't just keep it. All of the costs and all of the savings that an auto insurer has are passed on in the rate. The Office of Insurance Regulation is able to review the rate. Auto insurance is really a pass-through business. So it is not correct to say that if we were to sue, let's say, a chain of chiropractic clinics for years of overbilling, that perhaps we didn't catch for several years. It's on us. And we receive funds back. If we have to hire our own lawyers and pay our own lawyers, we have to net that expense against any of the recovery. If there's an attorney fee grant, then, of course, we get the attorney fees and we get the recovery. That is a credit against expenses. So our expenses in the rate filing will be lower than they would have been. And that's what OIR sees. I would say as to transparency, something very interesting. There have been some lawsuits, very interesting ones. And in some of these cases where there's large dollars at stake, the other side, the defendant, demands a confidential settlement agreement as a condition of settling the case. I think true transparency may be found where we can actually take those, crack them open, so that you, the Office of Insurance Regulation, the CFO, Division of Investigative and Forensic Services, can actually see what these settlements are about and what we're alleging and what they're admitting or speaking to in the settlements. So with that, Mr. Chairman, just raise those concerns with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, Mr. Carlson, Rep. Stevenson has a question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I expected, so what you're saying is if there's a net benefit, it's reported in your rate filing?
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Yes, that's correct.
Which I figured there would be something to that effect. Is there anything when you find a case and there's a confidential settlement and there's bad behaviors or maybe it's not a confidential, is there anything that bars people from then being claimants in the future or being part of the system that's covered by the insurance, so you have to keep finding them again and again? Is there any penalties for the bad actors' continued engagement in the same kind of practices, maybe just regrouping their organization? Just curious.
You recognize.
I think you know current law probably provides penalties. That, if you commit insurance fraud as a criminal act, certainly you'll be subject to the criminal penalties of state law. I don't know the healthcare licensing regulatory regime, well enough to know whether there are penalties over there for continued bad acts, but I would imagine there might be.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Rep. Steele, did you have a question? Mr. Carlson, I think Rep. Steele has a question.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. You know, how often do you see repeat offenders from plaintiffs? And I'm not talking about the chiropractic, networks. I'm talking about individuals that actually do this on a regular cadence.
You're recognized.
If I could, point of clarification, Representative, when you say plaintiffs, you mean suing the companies?
Yes.
If I could, Mr.
Yes.
If you could describe what you're talking about here, suing the companies for underpayments, if that's what you're saying?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I'll give you an example. We have a representative that was involved in a roll accident, and this person's already got $250,000 worth of, claim from an injury. And so that kind of occurrence.
You recognize?
I think, Mr. Chairman, if we're talking about PIP claims or BI claims, you see a lot of people, particularly in the PIP world, with repeat claims, repeat lawsuits, staged accidents. We'll have five people in a car, that's five lawsuits, et cetera. You do see a lot of that behavior because of the incentive system that's there to before you all passed meaningful tort reform to get attorney fees. So that was kind of what was driving that.
Follow up. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Rep. Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, during your presentation, you indicated that all the savings are passed on to the rates of the consumers, right? How much of that savings did you have, let's just say last year, how much money did you have, like a ball estimate?
Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
Representative, I don't have a number. I don't know what savings might have been. I mean, we're the auto, as everybody probably knows, unfortunately, auto rates are rising. Auto losses are increasing. So that's what the situation is we're in. I would be happy to go back and talk to our members and see if they can tell me, let's say, the value of the clawbacks, these cases that we're talking about related to the bill, and be happy to get that number to you.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to see that number. You know, how much was the total and how much of that was really passed on to consumers. Is that a fair ask?
You recognize.
I think trying to get to the total number will be something we'll work on in terms of how the rates were passed on. I think it's something that is better addressed to the Office of Insurance Regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I would like.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Should I stay for a minute? Thank you, Chair.
I think you're free to go. Okay, we are in debate. That's our last public testimony. In debate, Representative Steele.
Thank you, Chair. And Rep, thank you for bringing this bill and having the conversation we had last night. I'm going to be up on the bill currently. I have major concerns with fraud that happens, and I think it's on the other side of the fence, not on this side. There's networks that are used on a regular cadence to bring litigation against insurance companies with zero injury, and they're, you know, advertising all over the place on billboards of the amount of money that's won just to get more people to join force. So I think we need to do something with those individuals. Maybe we add something for a scheme to defraud on the other side so there's protection on both ends. Thank you.
Further debate? Rep. Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be up on this bill today, and I'm aware in my business as a lawyer that there's always claims that there's some type of fraud going on with regards to claims. I just remind everybody that oftentimes litigation is predicated on the fact that there's a denial of a good claim as well. So keep that in mind.
Further debate. Rep. Stevenson.
Thank you. Well, as I understand this bill, they assume that the net results of a denial, of a good claim, which would result in them paying a penalty, I guess that would be, or not, a benefit, is included in the rates already. So I do not see the necessity of this bill. If I understand there's a necessity for this bill, I'll be up. But today I'm going to be down on the bill.
Further debate. Seeing none, I'll just add I find Mr. Carlson's suggestion about including the confidential amounts, perhaps, an intriguing idea if you are looking to amend this going forward. With that, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to having Mr. Carlson in my office and to have a conversation on this. As you guys all know, my door is always open, and I look forward to having an amendment somewhere down the line here. As everybody else, I want to thank everybody for returning my phone call and returning my text on this good bill. And I ask for your favorable support.
Thank you. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Duggan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Abbott.
Yes.
Ranking Democratic Member Honshofsky.
Yes.
Representatives Anderson is excused. Benjamin.
Yes.
Barrero.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Kennedy.
Yes.
Fabricio. Franklin.
Yes.
Griffiths.
Yes.
King.
Yes.
Plakin.
Yes.
Rudman is excused. Steele.
Yes.
Stevenson?
No.
Tant?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Tremont? Woodson?
Yes.
Thank you. Members, by your action, that bill will be reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Our last bill is proposed committee substitute for HB 1149, policy cancellations and non-renewals by property insurers. Again, by Representative Botana, you are recognized to present from your seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This PCS for HB 149 changes when an authorized insurer may cancel or non-renewal personal, residential, or commercial residential property insurance policies on properties with unrepaired damages. Two, this PCS also states the term damage include flood damage related to hurricane is flood coverage peril under insured policy and affect the time lost of which damage remains unrepaired. The PCS establishes a standard for cancellation and non-renewal for such policies issued by surplus lines. Members, that is the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Franklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks so much for your conversations earlier this morning. My question's around a wind insurer. So typically it sounds like within the bill, if I'm a wind insurer and the customer might not have flood insurance and flood causes the damage, would I still be on risk, I guess you could say, for that scenario? And if so, what's the thesis behind having that within the bill?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the person has flood and wind, they would both be on until that is repaired. As far as wind, if that is, if they're both there, one is off, one's on, and then on. This is the main thing is if there's a business or there's a property that's owned by this person, and there's a problem, and with the hurricane blowing through like our area did with Hurricane Ian, we had a lot of issues where these folks were uninsured. They couldn't get any insurance because they were on there past the 90 days to get rebuilt or, kind of clarify. You go out there to a unexposed market, it turns into a real problem.
Follow up. Further questions? Rep. Stevenson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Batana, I appreciate your conversation. I had a very different experience than you did in your district, but is your concern that somebody has a flood-damaged property and is in the process, perhaps even, of repairing and another storm hits and they have wind damage? Is that part of your concern?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the good question. My concern is we have, in my district with Hurricane Ian, we had a lot of folks that were flooded out. They had flood insurance, and then they had wind insurance, and then the flood would say, oh, it was from rain or that where that's going down the line. That's my concern, where they say, oh, this wasn't us, and now we're out after 90 days. So this says that you have to stay on until the repairs are done. We don't want to leave Floridians exposed out there.
Follow up.
Yeah, thanks. I would like to add something, because many of us have had hurricane damage and may have had a very different experience, but I went down to Representative Botana's area, and one of the comments that the then acting county administrator said was one of the problems they were having was this very issue that the structure was gone, and they're arguing about whether it was wind or flood, kind of. There was some one of the things. In my area, it was very clear when we experienced damage in the three storms and hurricanes that we were affected by. There was water, and you could see it on the wall, and there was also, or wind. It was, or wind-driven rain. So I never understood how clear that can be, and it my experience was very different than your experience. So I think I am very interested in this issue that people get treated fairly by their insurers, and that there's an objective way to look at it, and also if there's a period of time when you're in the process of rebuilding that you don't have insurance in case there's a second storm, which we have had things where there's a second hit. So I'm very interested in the subject. I have some concerns about the clarity in an experience like you had where there's argument between the flood and the wind. So I'm very interested in your bill. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none. Representative Botana, you are recognized to explain Amendment Number 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a cross-reference in the bill.
Thank you. Questions on the amendment? I see no amendments to the amendment. We have no public testimony on the amendment. We're in debate on the amendment. Seeing none, you are recognized to close on the amendment. Waive close without objection. Show that amendment adopted. We're back on the bill as amended. We have public testimony. Travis Moore, Community Associations Institute, waves in support. Thank you. Caitlin Murray, National Association of Mutual Insurance, waves in opposition. Donovan Brown, Wholesale and Specialty Insurance Association, waves in opposition. Michael Carlson, Personal Insurance Federation of Florida. You're recognized.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members, and this is when we did have the conversation on Representative Patano, so thank you so much for the time.
I want to thank the sponsor, and I want to thank the chairman, and I want to thank the staff in particular for taking what was very problematic for us in the base bill and making it much better in the PCS. We really do appreciate that. We appreciate the forward movement. There are two issues I want to raise. One is an ask, and the other is I want to elevate this concern about staying on a risk that we don't write. So to the ask, one of the things that the PCS does not contemplate is tying the prohibition on cancellation or non-renewal to a declaration of a state of emergency or an emergency order issued by the Commissioner of Insurance. We would respectfully request that you consider delimiting the prohibitions to those periods. We fully recognize that there are situations where homeowners are damaged and they need to retain coverage for a period of time. The way things normally work in Florida, I hate to say normal again, I did that in the Senate, in these crisis moments, the Office of Insurance Regulation steps in and says no one cancels, no one non-renews. And that is a relatively time-limited period. You know, it can be 90 days, can be sometimes more. But that also sometimes limits the scope. So for these counties that are affected under the Declaration of Emergency, we're going to say no one cancels and non-renews. That gives us very nice and clear guidance and also keeps us focused on a narrow territory to the Ian experience, for example, a more narrow geographical territory. So I would ask that you consider that. I think that, you know, that's in the current law on the CAT side. It would be great if we could sort of get to one standard. And I know you have one standard for flood and for covered peril. It'd be nice to have that limited somewhat by a declaration of emergency. The second issue is much more complicated. And the bill, the PCS, would require a national writer like the ones we represent who write wind only, all perils wind, but not flood, to retain a risk for a period of time. It's either the earlier of when the risk is repaired or a one policy renewal. I think the policy renewal idea is very elegant. It's very clean for us in terms of implementation. But here's the problem. If we don't write flood, we do not feel like we should be limited. We should be required to maintain a policy because we didn't write the damage. We didn't insure the damage. We don't necessarily know the status of repairs, although your PCS does have a nice provision about us being able to inquire now on status of repair. So it's hard for us to kind of know what the time frame is under the bill. But more particularly, for someone outside of a flood zone, an insurance company that's writing risk in Florida, if this were to become law, we would all look at flood maps. We would all say, all right, what's my flood risk most acute in the state? And then we're going to decide, do we want to write an HO3 policy for wind and other perils in that area out of the fear that we may be caught and required to stay on a risk because of flood, which we don't write? And that's a very serious concern that we have. We would rather, and we're comfortable staying on risks that we cover. And the first part of the bill on the prohibition actually does that. So I just want to raise that issue. As the bill continues to move, I'd love to keep that conversation alive. If flood were not a requirement, I think a potentially strong disincentive would disappear. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much.
Our next public testimony is from Ashley Khalifi, Florida Surplus Lines Association. You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The surplus lines market, for people who are not super familiar, writes what the admitted market will not write, and it has the necessary tools and flexibility to be able to do that. So when you can't find coverage in the standard market, a lot of times you get what's called exported to the surplus lines market, and they can write kind of the riskiest things, the biggest things, the most complicated things. We are not aware of any other state that goes this far, and so we're kind of in uncharted territory. We've done some research on our own and haven't found anything close to similar to what, frankly, current law is, much less this bill. We've met with the sponsor, and I know his intentions are very, very good. Insurance companies, admitted and non-admitted, risk capital for a specified and specific peril for a duration of time. And, you know, we kind of stand for the not-so-radical concept that we don't think it's radical, that should mean something, right? And so we think that this bill, by transforming one-year policies into multi-year policies, particularly for things that we do not cover, is problematic. think there might be some constitutional issues. But again, like Michael said, it's really going to affect the appetite of wind insurers to write in flood-prone areas. And it's going to affect the ability, their ability, to provide competitive prices to those people. I know you have a presentation about a statewide wind pool, and I am sincerely concerned that this might get you part of the way there. I'm also concerned, as Michael said, that transforming one-year policies into multi-year policies for any claim, including non-CAT claims, has some very obvious moral hazards. If someone is afraid that they might not get renewed, they could just file any claim, and then the company has to offer a renewal. I think it's true that most insurance companies want to do the right thing. Car dealerships don't make more money by selling less cars, and the same is true for insurance companies. We do not make more money by selling less policies. We would like to deploy capital in this market, and I think there's a lot of excitement from national carriers, admitted and non-admitted, that the things that this legislature has done and this governor has done is going to make that a lot easier to do. And I think the first quarter of 2024 is going to bear some really productive fruit from the standpoint of the risk appetite of the national market. And I really am concerned that things like this that tie their hands of the ability to have certainty in their contracts are going to take us a step backwards. I'll go back to my car dealership analogy because I think that the retail insurance agents who are very supportive of this bill actually have the solution in their hands, which is if there are a few bad apples in the insurance industry that may be treating people unfairly, I would recommend that they not sell their policies. I don't go buy cars at car dealerships who I think are going to sell me lemons. I think that having a bill that's going to affect the overall risk appetite of the entire market, a bill that doesn't look anything like any other law in any other state, is maybe a bridge too far when the actual solution is if there are some bad apples that are doing things that probably we all agree are uncomfortable, I would not sell their policies. So I think hopefully we have some more work to do. Representative Botana, I can attest to the fact that he does have a very open-door policy. And I think all of us want to do the right thing, and we want to get to the right place. We want to make sure, as a native Floridian myself, I've been in the situation where your home is destroyed, it's flooded out. I mean, a lot of us have been there. And so we do want the right thing for all of our neighbors to happen, but we also want to make sure that they can buy policies and not just from citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no further public testimony. We're in debate. Rep. Steele.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep., for bringing this great bill. I kept hearing not covered, not covered. And, you know, I started thinking about flood and what is flood. You know, there's a debate that wind causes the water to rise from the Gulf because the Gulf can't flood, right, typically. And so I would like you to add something to the bill that actually defines, you know, that, because there is a controversy between what caused the rising water. It's not a river overflowing. This is wind pushing water in, so it's not a flood. It's wind damage, in my opinion. I'm not an attorney, but I've talked to a couple of them, and they have the same debate back and forth. Just because a law does not exist anywhere else doesn't mean it's not good law, and so I want to make sure that's a point as well. So thank you for bringing this forward. I look forward to seeing the, you know, revisions on it, but thanks.
Rep. Stevenson.
Yeah, it is concerning that it might, we want the national insurers in. That was one of the discussions. I think some of the members had concerns that, but we've had troubles getting the national insurers in, or the PUPs, which is kind of a new thing for us, for me at least, that terminology. But I am interested in the challenges that were reported to me when I went and inspected your area. Sometimes it's very clear that it's a rising water issue, and there's a watermark line, and they say from here down it's flood, and from here up it's wind. That's the way I understood. But in the experience you had, I'm not as certain. And so I will support this bill. I do certainly do not want to pass policy that causes a big increase in citizens. That would be problematic as well. But hopefully there's a way to thread the needle and address some of the concerns your constituents experienced after Ian. Thank you.
Further debate? Seeing none, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to everyone that's come up and spoke. Like I said, it's great to have this conversation and great to have to talk with our members here. After Hurricane Ian, you know, we had 14 feet on Fort Myers Beach. We had 10 feet in Bonita and 6 feet in Sanibel. We had members, constituents flooded out and still dealing with issues. I think this bill is a step in the right direction for that. You know, as far as, you know, scaring off new business into Florida, I thought we did that last year with our reform to bring new business in here. And as far as I can see, it's working the right way. Like I say, I'm not an attorney. I'm just a business guy up here. When ideas come up that sound good, I was like, well, that does sound pretty good. But I thank you very much and hope to have your support on this bill. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Duggan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Abbott?
Yes.
Ranking Democratic Member Honshofsky? Representatives, Anderson is excused. Benjamin?
Yes.
Guerrero?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Kennedy?
Yes.
Fabricio? Franklin?
Yes.
Griffiths?
Yes.
Keene?
Yes.
Flaken?
Yes.
Rutman is excused. Steele?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Tremont? Woodson?
Yes.
Thank you, members. That bill will be reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Botana. Members, our next item on the agenda is a discussion of windstorm coverage. It relates to some of the issues we've already been talking about today. Let me just kind of give you the roadmap. This is going to be a 30-minute block. We're going to have 10 minutes of presentation from Representatives Roach and Cassell. Then we're going to have 10 minutes from Mr. Cirio of Citizens, and then we're going to have 10 minutes of questions by us. And we are going to stick to those time limits, regardless of how much time we have left in the meeting. So with that, Representative Roach, you are both recognized and may switch back and forth as you need.
Thank you, Chair Duggan. I know that your committee time is valuable, and I want to thank you for allowing us to present this today. Recognize Vice Chair Abbott, Ranking Member Honshofsky. I think she just stepped out. Committee members, friends, and colleagues. I would also be remiss if I did not recognize and thank former State Representative Don Crane, who served in this chamber from 1970 to 1974. He was an industry insurance executive, owned an insurance company, and really pioneered this idea with a study group back in 2006. So this idea is not new, but what is new is the opportunity to put this out here for public discussion, and I'm deeply, deeply grateful to Speaker Renner for allowing us this opportunity today. Members, I don't think there's any member of this committee, insurance and banking. In fact, I'll go a step further and say that I doubt there is a single member of this House, perhaps this legislature, that would disagree when I make the statement that Florida is experiencing the worst property insurance crisis this state has ever seen. On my desk in my office, I have a letter from a one Mr. Thomas Baker, Florida resident, who sent me a 6-page letter with a big red insert that says, "Please help, my property insurance has increased by 650%. His plight is indicative of many Floridians, many homeowners that are paying more for property insurance than they ever have before, with rate increases that are higher than they've ever been before and more frequent rate increases than the state has ever experienced before. This is the problem. And I'm here today, along with my colleague, Representative Hillary Cassell, to tell you and to tell Mr. Thomas Baker and others like him that we have the solution. I'd like for you to think about a state, one of the three largest states in this great union, that has been beset by decades of natural disasters, resulting in billions upon billions of dollars in property damage. And after every one of these natural disasters, the homeowners insurance market gets shakier and shakier and shakier until it finally collapses. And by collapse, I mean that 93% of the market had declined to cover natural disasters or simply pulled out of the state altogether. And the legislature was forced to do something. And so they did. They adopted a plan to create a nonprofit, publicly managed, privately financed insurance entity that did two things. It provided insurance for all claims and only claims related to these natural disasters and left the private market to pick up the rest. The result, rates dropped like a stone. The private market came back and was able to write your typical bread and butter homeowners insurance policies without ever having to worry about insuring the incalculable risk of these natural disasters. Private industry made a fortune. That state was the state of California. The year was 1996, and the bill creating the California Earthquake Authority was signed into law by Republican Governor Pete Wilson. I would also mention Texas as well, which has been offering a version of universal wind coverage since 1971. We've got 50 years of empirical data from Texas and about 30 years of empirical data from the state of California. So this is not merely theoretical. I believe that Florida will eventually and inevitably follow this model. I don't think many members of the public realize how precipitously close the insurance industry came to collapsing after Hurricane Ian. And had we had another Ian a few months ago, the market surely would have collapsed. Our proposal is to reform Citizens so that it will provide universal windstorm coverage where excess premiums are going to be used to carry forward to pay windstorm claims in subsequent years. Under our plan, Citizens would become the insurer of first resort for Florida homeowners seeking wind coverage. We have really two objectives here. Affordable premiums for homeowners, allow the free market to cover all other claims, and then indemnification in the event of a catastrophe. You want your claim paid. And you might ask, well, Representative Roach, isn't that how insurance works? But what I would say is that what we've learned in Florida from years of paying high premiums to undercapitalized fly-by-night insurance companies is that a paper insurance policy does not guarantee that your losses will be covered. In other words, just because you have an insurance policy doesn't mean you have insurance. How do we accomplish these objectives? We isolate the risk, which is what this proposal seeks to do, and states like California and Texas have done. Members, there are three truths when you consider this. There are three indisputable, unchallengeable, undebatable, undeniable facts. One, it's impossible for insurance companies to accurately forecast risks when it comes to hurricane, right? Because no one knows how much hurricane damage is going to occur in their covered properties during the next 12 months. It's unknowable. The risk is uncalculable. Two, we live on a peninsula. We're surrounded by water. These storms will continue to ravage Florida's coastline. There will be another big storm. And three, we know that the current system is not working for Florida homeowners and taxpayers. So I would ask you to ask yourselves these questions as you listen to this presentation. Is what we're doing now working for our constituents? What does the data show from other states like California and Texas, and what best practices can we take and learn from? And then three, what is the risk of doing nothing?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, members of the committee. In preparation for today's presentation, I did a lot of reading, and I went back and found a commission report that was done in 1993 post-Hurricane Andrew. And if you were to read the report today, it's as if you're reading today's news headlines. It talks about the same problems that our marketplace is currently experiencing, that we've been experiencing since 1993, and honestly prior to that. It's mass cancellations, non-renewals, insurance companies going insolvent, leaving the state, a lack of capacity, high cost of reinsurance. Those are the issues that plagued our system in 1993, and those are the issues that still plague our system today. We're seeing a lot of headlines out there that are talking about, you know, there's light at the end of this tunnel. We've got six new insurance companies, seven new insurance companies that have entered the state. But who have we allowed to enter the state? The same problems that plague us today, which are companies that came in, they're small domestic carriers, they're undercapitalized, they don't have the finances to cover these claims, and as a result, rely heavily on a reinsurance market. We know reinsurance costs are what drive premiums. They account for anywhere between 40 to 50% of what consumers are paying in their everyday insurance premium. So of the seven new companies that have entered the state, all of them are also still currently being rated by a single ratings company, Demotech. All of them have received A ratings. But when you compare that to independent rating companies such as Weiss, an insurance company like Slide, who has received an A rating from Demotech, has a D-plus from an independent rater. These are the problems that plagued our system in 1993. They plagued it in 2006, and they plague it today in 2023. So when we talk about whether or not the insurance industry is coming back because of the reforms that we've passed, sadly, the reality is all we're doing is creating the same mistakes. It's insanity to continue to do what we've done for the last 30 years over and over and over and expect a different outcome. We've heard multiple bills presented today where we've heard insurance company representatives basically threaten that if we ask them to stay on to protect consumers for 1 year after a catastrophic loss, that they're going to leave the state. Well, our plan works for one reason. There's one insurance company in the state of Florida that can never go insolvent, and that's Citizens. Citizens is created to be here for us in our time of greatest need. They can't leave our state. They're set to be here for us during that time. We went 12 years without a storm. As soon as we got a storm, insurance companies began to claim that they didn't have the funds to cover it. We know that the insolvencies that have plagued the state are a result of undercapitalization, poor management of funds, paying executives. By turning our dollars over to Citizens, those things are no longer existent. In good years, when we go 12 years without a storm, those dollars that we collect on premiums under our plan will go to a bank and sit and wait for that rainy day. We won't be worried about executives receiving payouts that we can't follow, that we can't track, that go into third parties. The biggest concern, though, when we talk about this type of plan is the assessments and the risk that we as Floridians bear. Well, we already bear that risk. We bear it when private companies go insolvent, and we bear it with the potential of Citizens. And when I think about hurricanes, as devastating as they can be, I often think about what happens after the storm.
Rep, you have 1 minute.
Thank you, sir. After a storm, usually your neighbors come together. You go outside when you don't have electricity. You share resources. You have those conversations. You meet with your neighbors, and you help each other out. Floridians go from coast to coast, bringing resources, bringing supplies. Neighbors helping neighbors. Floridians helping Floridians. That's what our plan does. This plan allows Florida and Floridians to take care of themselves. In the event of an assessment, which is always our biggest concern, whether we get them from FIGA when the private companies go under or we get it as a result of a Citizens assessment, I would rather know that I'm saving money on a premium with a Citizens policy like this, and if an assessment happens, my money is going to bail out my neighbor and not bail out an insurance company executive. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent time management by you both. Yeah. Our next participant is Mr. Cirio, Tim Cirio, President and CEO of Citizens. Mr. Cirio, I will give you a one-minute warning as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Chairman.
You're recognized.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Chair Roach and Representative Cassell for caring about this issue. It is a tremendously important issue, and the Citizens Board has not taken a position on statewide wind-only measures. So we want to provide information that this is a very different change in direction. It would fundamentally change the mission of Citizens. And although they haven't taken a position, I would say we've been focusing as the market has recovered. We want to take good care of the policies we have, but we've been focusing on depopulation. And for obvious reasons, this would turn that in a different direction. Citizens currently offers wind-only coverage to coastal areas in 29 of Florida's 35 coastal counties. It is important to note that we offer policies with wind coverage included in multi-peril in all 67 counties. Multi-peril, of course, includes wind, but wind-only and multi-peril are offered in all in the 29 regions, but wind-only is only in these 29 coastal counties. So to evaluate and take a look at market share, we're using industry data that was provided by the Office of Insurance Regulation. The latest data available is from September 30 of 2023. Just to update these figures a little, I will say that we have made really strong progress in depopulation. Personal residential, as of December 31st, we've shrunk down to 1.2 million policies with 444 million in exposure. Commercial residential, on the other hand, has grown. You'll see on the chart from around 4,200 policies to over 13,500 policies with $109 billion in exposure. That is a tremendous figure, and we're seeing a tremendous amount of growth in commercial residential. Citizens has 15% of the personal residential multi-peril market for companies writing more than 10,000 policies. And that's sort of a significant sort of cutoff. That's why we chose it. There are 58 companies that write multi-peril policies. Only 7 companies have at least 10,000 policies and write ex-wind policies, or policies that exclude wind. Citizens has 5% of that market. And there's only one company writing more than 10,000 wind-only policies, one private company. And in that market, Citizens holds 80% of the market share. For the commercial residential market, Citizens has 16% of the multi-peril business, where there's 18 carriers writing such policies. 8 companies write ex-wind, and we have 21% of that market in the commercial residential. And for wind only, we're the only, unfortunately, we're the only game in town in that business for commercial residential. There are really 5 issues that I think it's important for the committee to consider in this workshop. Pricing, settlement practices by the private industry, because as you may know, what this bill will require is, although we will provide the backup for the wind-only coverage, we'll write the check. The private insurers who don't have the coverage are the ones adjusting the claims and making a determination as to the loss. Issues with the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund and assessment. The bottom line is that all of these points is that assessments, at the end of the day, what we're going to show, unfortunately, is that assessments are going to, or the potential for assessment is going to increase exponentially. This shows the pricing inadequacy in personal and commercial residential policies, the current price inadequacy. But you can extrapolate as to what it would look like if we went statewide wind only. Currently, for personal residential, the water and all other perils subsidize the wind peril for the personal lines account homeowner multi-peril rates. So even with this subsidy, homeowners' rates in the aggregate, you can see, are still inadequate by about 40.5%. And when I was here last week, I talked about our rate inadequacy, the fact that we're charging actuarially unsound rates. If Citizens were to offer the homeowner product statewide for just the wind peril, that rate inadequacy would be about 103.1%. And of course, the legislation does not require that we charge actuarially sound rates, which is where we're trying to get. So we would essentially need to more than double our rates to have an actuarially sound rate. But that's the rate indication for personal residential. For commercial residential, these mainly cover the condo associations and apartment buildings, where the all other category and sinkhole peril subsidize the wind peril once again. Even with this subsidy, commercial residential rates in the aggregate are still inadequate by 87.2%. And if Citizens were to offer commercial residential products statewide for just wind, that rate inadequacy would be 183.9%. So based on the personal and commercial residential pricing alone, we would expect significant growth just because of competition. There would be no competition. It would not make economic sense for somebody to have somebody in the private sector try and write a wind-only policy, and we don't think there'd be an incentive for the private sector to do so. So the current inadequate rates that exist for these segments of business and the likely influx of new policies at an inadequately priced rates, along with a substantial increase in exposure, are concerning, not just from a pricing perspective, but also from a risk transfer perspective, which I'll talk about in a moment. So if Citizens is to provide windstorm coverage in the private market, provides the ex-wind coverage, or excludes wind. The legislation would have the ex-wind company adjust and settle the wind losses. And again, this is concerning for a number of reasons. You need, when you're settling claims, when you're making these determinations, there's an incentive when you have skin in the game, for lack of a better term. Otherwise, you're giving companies rights to your purse, and there's no downside for them. There's no consequences. And as an example, this is why insurance has deductibles. Having no deductible would cause insurance costs to skyrocket in many cases, because the policyholder doesn't make the determination, is this worth fixing myself, or is it? Do I really need to pay the deductible and turn it over to my insurance? Reinsurers know this, and this is key for the reinsurers. Citizens currently receives lower rates, partly because the reinsurers understand our claims-paying practices. They've dove in. They understand how we process claims, and this could have a negative impact on our premiums or even our ability to get reinsurance at all, because they're not going to be, they're familiar with us, but they would also have to be familiar with how maybe 60 other private carriers are going to be handling and adjusting claims that we are responsible to pay for. That will be a concern to reinsurers. Detecting and fighting fraud is an example. It takes careful analysis of how claims are handled, combined with the cost associated, You know, that's, for example, here, the claims department has to collect the right kind of data to chase the fraud. And you have to understand what data you're chasing, and the reinsurers are going to want to understand that as well. How do we keep a handle on fraud? So it's just, it's the bottom line is, this is sort of akin to the National Flood Insurance Program, which where you have actuarially unsound rates, like the NFIP does, and somebody else paying the claim. And we've seen that that insurance right now, it's currently in its current form, is just, it's a disaster. So it just, overall, this would make it very difficult for citizens to put controls in place to be a good steward of our surplus. We've seen how this went very wrong with AOB. AOB, you know, we didn't have great control of the claim. Work would be done. We would get a bill, and we would have to pay it. I think the reforms that the legislature passed on AOB have made it, they have been a game changer, and they've allowed us to take better control of the claims process, and the reinsurers have noted this. So the bottom line, it's going to make it harder for citizens to control our claims cost, and we think to get reinsurance. This slide shows how much more reinsurance could cost if citizens were to grow from writing additional wind policies, as we think we would. To estimate the possible impact to reinsurance, we created three scenarios that assumes a 50%, 75%, and 100% of the wind policies from the industry would move to citizens, which is very, as cheap as we would be, it's a very foreseeable scenario. Assuming 50% of the wind policies from the industry moved to citizens, the total insured exposure would be almost three times more than the current book of business, and the reinsurance costs would increase by 333%. As of the figures I show you here, we have $618 billion in total exposure. That figure would jump to $1.6 trillion. And our reinsurance costs would jump from $650 million to $2.8 billion.
Mr. Sirio, you have 1 minute.
Yes.
1 minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me jump ahead. Assuming 100% of the wind policies from the industry moved to citizens, the total insured exposure would be $3.17 trillion. And our reinsurance costs would be $5.6 billion. I don't even know if there would be enough capacity in the market that would allow us to obtain the necessary amount of reinsurance. There are questions regarding the CAT fund. We don't know what the role would be to the CAT fund, for a CAT fund, if we're the only payer. And then lastly, let me hit these scenarios. We've tried to estimate the impact if there was a hurricane like an Andrew or the 1926 Great Miami Hurricane that hit us. You can see here that if we had an Andrew hit right now, we would be fine. There'd be no assessment. Great Miami Hurricane, a very, very small assessment. If Andrew hit and we have CAT fund coverage, we can still expect anywhere from a $645 billion assessment, which would basically be a 10% assessment, trying to provide some helpful facts.
Obviously, for the people who are answering, be as complete in your answers as possible, but also succinct if possible. So our first question will come from Representative Fabricio.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, members, for the presentation. This question is to Mr. Sirio. So I'll couch it in this, and I'll be as brief as possible. So if over the last several years we've been working towards ensuring that Citizens is the insurance carrier of last resort as a safety net, so to speak, like in Miami-Dade County, we have a safety net hospital, and in the state of Florida, we have a safety net insurance carrier. If we were to push it to the head of the line and ensure that it's the insurer of first resort for these type of policies, in your view, sir, what would occur to the free market that we've been trying to create to attract more capital to absorb that risk in Florida?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, what we have seen with the reform so far, we have seen new entrants into the market. We have seen reinsurers being very encouraged by what they see, willing to deploy more capital. And one of the things that we have harped on, for lack of a better word, to you all, to the OIRs, our rates are still too low. We think our rates are distorting competition. And when you talk about being the safety net, what is the net? Is it to be available when there's no other avenue for reinsurance, which is what we're supposed to be? sometimes that conflicts with affordability, right? I mean, we are statutorily mandated to charge actuarially sound non-competitive rates, and that's not happening. This would, because of the glide path, and this would just, if we go statewide wind only without charging actuarially sound rates, that would exacerbate, and I think the issue, and it's a policy decision either way, whatever the legislature wants to do, but it will pull more private policies into citizens, and we would, you just need to recognize that what you're doing, you're not, it's not a private, it's not a private, you're not promoting the private market, which is a little bit different than the philosophy that we have now to try and get our rates up and be actuarially sound and non-competitive as required by Florida law to be.
Thank you. Rep. Whitson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good presentation. My question is, of the new companies that have entered the marketplace, how many of those are riding residential, commercial, for condominiums?
You recognize?
I think one, right? Just one. Just one representative.
Rep. Steele.
Thank you, Chair. Do you have to have, and this is for the reps, sorry.
Yep.
Thank you. And I commend you guys for taking this approach. Do you have to have homeowners to have the wind coverage?
You recognize.
Do you have to have homeowners to have the wind coverage? Mm-hmm. This is conceptual and theoretical, but my answer or my advocacy would be no. Okay.
And then are you going to straighten out the complex problem between rising water from wind versus flood?
Well, Chairman.
Yes, you're right.
Thank you. That's exactly what we're trying to do, and what we see happening so frequently, and has happened, you know, to my constituents, and I'm sure yours, is anytime this happens, you have the flood coverage and the homeowners insurance pointing fingers at each other. No one wants to cover it. No one wants to pay. And you know, look, we're all shaped in part by our experiences. But I'll tell you that in hearing from my constituents, hundreds of them, if not thousands, after Ian, I had very, very few complaints about how they were treated under the National Flood Insurance Program versus almost universal complaints about how they were treated by their homeowners insurance company, which just prevaricated, deny, delay, until these homeowners were forced to accept pennies on the dollars for their claim and move along because they got so desperate. I think that's kind of how the game works. But if you had, if you isolated this uncalculable risk to citizens, getting back to this free market argument that we just heard, this would absolutely incentivize the free market to come back into Florida, and they would thrive. I mean, think about why is Citizens providing coverages that the free market is able and willing to provide? We need to isolate, to segregate this incalculable risk, and that's what this program is designed to do.
Rep. Cassell, do you want to add anything? Okay, thank you. Rep. Tan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Citizens. I was listening to your presentation on the reinsurance rates, and do you find those rates acceptable?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. The rates that we're paying now, we've seen the rates, Representative, last year in the reinsurance market, they were not as high as we expected. And we think that the rates even this year are even more promising. I don't know if they'll be lower, but we think they're starting to level off. If we grow exponentially like that, I mean, I don't know if we could afford it, and I don't know even if we could, if there'll be the capacity to acquire that reinsurance. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure either. So the numbers that you presented were startling to me. And so given the flexibility afforded to citizens under the legislation, how much would you anticipate having to put aside for future claims versus the amount of coverage you would seek at the same time, assuming you think these rates are prudent?
So we are required by Florida law to use our best efforts to acquire enough reinsurance for a 1 in 100-year event. And I'm going to ask Brian Donovan, our chief actuary, to come up if I botch this. But what the point that we wanted to make was, under these scenarios with reinsurance, to cover the amount that we would that we're forecasting, it's a tremendous amount. Last year we bought $650 million in reinsurance. If we grow if 100% of the wind market comes to Citizens, which is very, very possible, that reinsurance amount jumps to $5.6 billion, or 645% more than what we had to buy last year.
Rep. Griffiths.
Thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. And this is probably for the reps. And I actually maybe have a question for each rep, as for Tim as well. But you mentioned the insolvency, the under-collateralized, the businesses, the insurance companies that are in the state are teetering on the edge. If citizens did not have the backing of the state taxpayers, would we consider them insolvent or teetering on the edge? How would they rank as a credit with the credit bureau?
You recognize?
If they did not have,
well, we just learned that we're $600 billion in exposure. So would that be considered a credit risk if they did not have the backing of the taxpayers to pick them up?
I'm gonna try to answer that the best that I can. So, you know, it's my belief and the belief of others who have studied this issue, and we can get you those studies, that one of the benefits of the centralized coverage that we're talking about is that it will reduce the need for reinsurance coverage for the windstorm pool, which is going to overall reduce the cost of providing coverage. I mean, I think that reinsurance rates, in fact, I know that it's 50% of the premium that's charged to policy. So one of the things that I feel that citizens may not be calculating in providing these numbers to you is a reduced reinsurance rate that they would pay if this proposal got legs and took off. So I think that a centralized pool that we're talking about is going to allow citizens to better manage their risk exposure using rates appropriate. And again, this what we're advocating, it's not free. People would pay a premium just like they do now for this coverage. And when you have those years without a storm, and thinking about where I live, I mean, we had our Hurricane Charley hit in 2004. The next significant storm was in 2017 with Hurricane Irma. That's a 13-year period. When you have those periods, perhaps 5 years, perhaps a decade, perhaps longer, without a significant storm, these premiums that people would pay for this coverage would continue to build and build and build and could be used subsequently to pay off these claims, instead of having those profits siphoned off to either another corporate entity or management company. Then those collateral reserves are not there when the claims need to be paid out. That's the problem we're experiencing in Florida. You would not have that problem if you had a universal wind coverage under Citizens. I'm not sure that I really addressed the root of your question, but that's what I have for you.
Rep. Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really want to add to that. One of the biggest concerns that we see right now with where Citizens geographically is located, where their policies are, it's in the highest risk zones. It's in the most vulnerable places. What our plan proposes is that Citizens actually has the ability to spread that risk out throughout the state into those places that are cherry-picked right now currently by carriers that are coming in and taking out policies and only taking out the best least risk policies possible. At the end of the day, Florida's still on the hook for the biggest policies and the biggest risk. Citizens insures the coast. Citizens insures condominiums. So when you look at potential reinsurance costs and any reinsurance savings, reinsurers are actually going to look at the fact that now Citizens is spread out across the state, doesn't just carry the highest risk, most vulnerable properties on its books. And because of that spread out of the risk, I think that'll also assist with reinsurance costs. And one of the reasons why Citizens is able to negotiate lower reinsurance costs in the private market is because we have the backing of the state, because it is an insurance company that can never go insolvent, because either the state will come in with an assessment. So I think that'll actually help reduce the reinsurance costs.
Last question, Rep. Benjamin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to go back to this concept that somehow this is going to cost Floridians more money, or somehow it's going to affect in a negative way our free market. You guys studied California and Texas. You guys took a look at what this plan would do or what it has done for their free market. Can you give us some of that data and to assure us how Florida may take to it?
You recognize?
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for the question. Yeah, so let me just say this. I mean, there are certainly look, this plan is not without criticism. It's not without controversy. If someone brings me a better idea, I'll be that champion. But I haven't found a better idea. And, you know, the criticism about, oh, it's going to bankrupt the state. Look, Texas, as I mentioned, has been doing this since 1971. They still don't have a state income tax. They're still financially solvent. So I think those things are a little overblown. And in terms of, like, data, here's some things I'm going to tell you, and I can send every member of this committee these reports. After the working group that Representative Crane put together back in 2006 produced document after document on this study, here are some of the people that looked at his plan. John Rollins, Citizens' former chief risk officer, reviewed the group's paper and wrote, and I quote, It's a surprisingly persuasive argument. Florida Tax Watch vetted his plan in 2011 and found the idea, and I quote, a viable one. It praised the fact that it was the only solution with mathematical modeling backing up. The former head of Citizens, a man named Barry Gilway, said he believes that while he believes competition among private insurers is the best way to lower rates, he said the idea, and I quote, is not unreasonable. So, and we have had, I have had insurance industry executives, agency owners, and I'm gonna differentiate that from lobbyists that represent the insurance industry in my office saying that this is a good idea, that they would support this. But there are a number of studies that have looked at this proposal, and I think there are lessons we can learn from Texas and lessons we can learn from California and take those best practices and make a model that's unique to Florida. But I am convinced that inevitably Florida will have to embrace this model.
And just to add to that, if we look at history, history is going to repeat itself, right? And the current situation that we find ourselves in is a result of small domestic companies coming in that were undercapitalized, that received a rating from a single company that had no history in any other states and that relied heavily on a reinsurance market. If history repeats itself in 20 years, our successors are going to be looking at the same crisis and asking why we haven't done more. Now is our opportunity to create a program where Florida saves Florida, we protect our neighbors, and we create a fund that will be there for us in a rainy day when these insurance companies leave us high and dry.
Thank you. That concludes our time. We went a little bit long, but this was a great discussion. I want to thank the representatives, Mr. Cirio, and your team for your presentation and the data. Thank you for the questions. This, I think, was designed to be thought-provoking. I hope you feel that it was. We'll see where it leads in the future. Members, that concludes our agenda for today, and it concludes the business of this subcommittee for this year. We will not meet again. Rep. Woodson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Ponchowski sent me a note to read to you since it's the last committee meeting, and it reads, Chair Duggan, it has been an honor to serve with you as the ranking member on the subcommittee for the past two sessions. You have always been kind, professional, and open to any discussion. Thank you for chairing all meetings in such a professional way and for treating all who present and testify before us with the respect they deserve. I appreciate you and your friendship, and it is an honor to serve with you, and I look forward to serving with you on another committee again in the future. And I second the motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Woodson. I appreciate that. And let me publicly thank Vice Ranking Member Ponchowski. It's been an honor and a pleasure to work with her as well. She has been a great partner for the work of this committee and the issues that we have tackled. And I, too, look forward to continuing to serve with her and thank her for those very kind words. And thank you for sharing them as well. I want to thank the Speaker for his trust and confidence in giving me this role. I want to thank our staff, Kurt Hammond, Kimberly Young, Eric Lloyd, Jennifer Fortenberry, Olivia Fletcher, and Daniela Herrera. They work very long hours, including all-nighters on one occasion at my behest. Sorry, I threw you under the bus there. But they do a fantastic job. And this is obviously very complicated, technical, arcane policy issues, and they are always on top of it. They know it like the back of their hand. We could not do our good work without them, and the citizens of the state benefit from that. So thank you all. We really appreciate you. I want to thank the vice chairs that I've served with. First, Rep. Fabricio, thank you, and Rep. Abbott, who unfortunately had to leave. Again, Ranking Member Ponchowski has been fantastic to deal with. I want to thank the stakeholders. Many of you are here today. It's been a pleasure to work with you. I appreciate the expertise that you bring to the issues, even though you have, you're in my office advocating, but you always have knowledge and expertise that informs me and our committee, and we thank you for your time. And then lastly, I just want to thank each of you for your engagement on this committee, your time, your service, from Representative Stevenson, a former chair, to Rep. Keene, our newest and shortest tenured member, but everybody engaged, everybody brought great insight and commitment to the process. And I just want to say thank you. You've done a great service, in my opinion, to the citizens of the state and to the members of the industry that we regulate. So with that, Rep. Barrero moves, we rise. Without objection, we are adjourned.